I will now turn the call over to Tara Tandon. Please go ahead.
Thank you, everybody, and welcome to this call that's jointly sponsored by the American Constitution Society and the Center for American Progress. I'm Neera Tandon, the Chief Operating Officer for the Center for American Progress, and I am going to open and welcome our guests. First, I'd like to tell everyone that this call is being recorded. I also am very honored to have Tim Jost and Cy Lazarus joining this call. Tim is a professor of law at the Washington and Lee University School of Law. He's an expert on health law and has written numerous books on healthcare regulation, comparative health law, and policy. Cy Lazarus is a public policy counsel of the National Seniors Law Center and one of the authors of the amicus brief filed in Virginia. Let me just start off by saying that we are speaking at a particularly important moment in the health reform litigation debate. We just last week had an important decision in the Michigan District Court dismissing the challenge to the law. We are pending a Virginia District Court. We have essentially October 18th next week. Oral arguments will begin. And very important, we are awaiting any moment, literally, a decision by the District Court on the Department of Justice motion to dismiss the claim. I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues and as a person who was working on the president's health care reform team to pass this law. I know how important this litigation is to ensure that the law survives and how the entire legislation works together to address the needs of the American people. And with that, I'm going to introduce my colleague, Cy Lazarus.
Thanks very much, Neera. I'm just going to briefly put in context the events of today and Monday that are the important upcoming events in the saga of this health reform litigation. There have already been three decisions from district courts in cases challenging the constitutionality of the health reform law. All of these are cases brought by conservative advocacy groups, not by state attorneys general. And in each one of these cases, there is a final decision out of the district court, and it has been to reject the challenges in each case. Last week, on October 7th, there was a very important decision that Neera referred to by a Michigan district court rejecting a challenge to the law. And the important thing about the Michigan decision is that that decision completely accepts and validates the core theory underlying the minimum coverage requirement or individual mandate that is the focus of most of the challenges. The court in that case clearly grasped and validated the indispensable link between having such a mandatory insurance requirement and being able to offer the patient's bill of rights that President Obama began implementing a couple of weeks ago. Neera is going to talk to that subject in more detail after Tim and I give our summaries of the cases. A second case that's very important is a California District Court decision, which was rendered at the end of August, and that decision has been appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out there. And in that case, the judge threw out the plaintiff's challenge on the ground that the plaintiffs had no standing to bring the suit because they had suffered no actual adverse effects, or they were not able to allege that they had suffered any adverse effects because the law is not going to go into effect until 2014, and they couldn't even really credibly demonstrate that they wouldn't, in one way or another, be covered by insurance so that they wouldn't be subject to the mandate. So those are very important bases of the Department of Justice's defense of the law, and they were validated in both of these cases. A third case came out of Maryland, and that case was also thrown out and immediately appealed to the Fourth Circuit. And Judge Wilkinson, a very respected, generally conservative judge on that circuit, rejected the appeal. So that case is finished entirely. So with that, I will turn this over to Tim.
Thank you, Cy. And I'm going to talk briefly about the Virginia and Florida cases. The Florida case, on which we expect a decision imminently, is a case that has been brought by 20 states challenging several aspects of the law. One of the primary things that it challenges in the law is the individual mandate, the requirement that everyone have minimum essential coverage. And Anira may talk more about that, but it's a requirement that is much less formidable than it first looks. Basically, it says that if you can afford health insurance, if you don't have a religious objection to it, if you're not otherwise insured, if you've been insured for more than 3 months, and if it wouldn't otherwise work a hardship on you, you have to buy a very basic insurance policy. So this is something that I think is just something every responsible person should do, and it's a little bit hard to understand why the states find this such a terrible provision. But anyway, that's one of the provisions challenged by the Florida case. The Florida case also raises a couple of other issues. One is it claims that the federal government is effectively commandeering the states to enforce the law. That's not true. The statute invites the states to enforce the law and respects state sovereignty in inviting the states to enforce the law in their own states. But it also says that if a state chooses not to, if a state doesn't want to take on that responsibility, the federal government will enforce the law in that state. And so and the law was very carefully crafted in light of previous Supreme Court decisions on federalism to make sure that it complied with the court's prior rulings. Also, the state says that the law changes the terms of the Medicaid program and that the federal government somehow is locked into the Medicaid program as it existed immediately before the adoption of the law and can't change it. Of course, the Medicaid program has changed continuously since it was first established in the 1960s. Also, the suit fails to mention that for the first 3 years of the Medicaid expansions beginning in 2014, the federal government will finance 100% of that law, and then only gradually will it phase down to 90%. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that over the next 10 years, $434 billion in Medicaid and CHIP funds would flow into the state from the federal government, and that the state share would only increase by $20 billion. So it's basically a federal program, but nonetheless the states are objecting to it. The federal government has moved to dismiss that case on jurisdictional grounds and on the law, and the judge has indicated that he may or may not do that. He set it for a later stage, what is called summary judgment. If the federal government wins today, if they win any part of the suit, that is huge because that's the end of the litigation. It means that they have successfully defended the law. If the federal government loses any part of its motion, that simply means that it did not meet the motion to dismiss standard, which is that there is no arguable case. There's no possible legal basis on which the states could succeed. So that's the framing of that case. With respect to the Virginia case, Virginia brought its own lawsuit because Virginia has its own statute claiming that the individual mandate is unconstitutional, or rather claiming that the individual mandate is unenforceable. Under our federal system, under the Supremacy Clause, if the statute is constitutional, then it's enforceable in Virginia. A state can't nullify a federal law. We fought a war over that, and the federal government won. But what happened in that case was, again, the federal government moved to dismiss. It moved to dismiss on jurisdictional grounds. It moved to dismiss on the law. And what the judge did in refusing the federal government's motion to dismiss in August was simply to say once again that Virginia had presented a plausible claim with an arguable legal basis. The court repeatedly emphasized that the decision did not resolve the merits of the claim, and as to quote the case, it will certainly not be the final word. So that case is now being briefed on the motion for summary judgment. But once again, all the court has held so far is that there is a possible legal claim on the part of the state.
And there'll be an oral argument on Monday about those motions for summary judgment by the Justice Department and Mr. Cuccinelli.
And so I would just like to just briefly mention how the reforms work together and why the minimum coverage provision is actually essential to the aspects of the legislation that are really working to protect consumers. I look at the health reform legislation as really a three-legged stool. And first and foremost, as part of the process of passing this legislation, it was important that we provide protections to consumers. The most important protections to consumers is the ability to ensure that everyone gets covered regardless of pre-existing conditions. That rests on the notion that everyone has access to health care, this idea of guarantee issue, meaning insurance companies cannot deny you because of your health status. Today, millions of Americans are dropped or never get coverage because they had an illness in the past. One of the promises of the legislation is that would never happen again. But to ensure that that promise is actually fulfilled, we need to have the minimum coverage provision, because at the end of the day, what can happen and what has happened and what will happen is if there is a requirement for guarantee issue, meaning insurers have to take all comers, and there isn't a minimum coverage provision, people can either choose to only get health insurance when they get sick or ignore issues until they're really very late in the process and are extremely costly. What could happen and has happened in several instances is that forms what is called a death spiral, meaning the sickest people get health insurance, costs drive up because the pool of those insured in the system are the sickest patients, and it makes it impossible for insurers to provide coverage, or they can only do it at high expense. That's why it's important to all Americans that there's a minimum coverage requirement. Today, in fact, we all pay $1,000 in premium. Families pay $1,000 in premium because the system is paying for people who don't have health insurance, and those costs are getting shifted onto the insured. So it's an issue of cost, and it's an issue of ensuring that the promises of the insurance protections, the patient's bill of rights aspects of this legislation are actually fulfilled. That was a core promise of this legislation, and if we lose the minimum coverage provision, all of the other insurance protections are at risk. And in addition, the Center for American Progress put forward a report authored by Jonathan Gruber in August of 2010 that actually went through an analysis of what would happen if we lost the minimum coverage provision. It's on our website. It's from August 2010. And Jonathan Gruber, who's a professor at MIT and has done tremendous analysis of the legislation and different proposals, found that if we repealed the minimum coverage requirement, the requirement to buy insurance, it would and we had a system where that was basically taken out of the legislation, premiums would rise by 27% in 2019. If we had a system where we kept the insurance reforms and lost the minimum coverage requirement, premiums would actually double in the space of a decade. And 7 million people would lose health insurance, the ability to get coverage. So obviously, this isn't just a theoretical argument. It is an argument that will affect everybody, and that's why the minimum coverage requirement is central to the legislation and ensuring that we keep costs down, and this legislation actually affords protections, the important consumer protections that Americans have come to need in today's insurance market.
Yeah, just to put a period on the end of Neera's presentation, that the judge in the Michigan decision that I mentioned earlier completely validated and accepted this argument. It's not just a matter of studies. He accepted it, and he noted that the experience of states that have tried to ban the pre-existing conditions exclusions, but did not have a minimum coverage requirement or an individual mandate, failed in every case. And he said that not to have the individual mandate, but to try to assure people of coverage without regard to whether they have pre-existing conditions, risked making premiums skyrocket or could drive the insurance market into extinction. And he used the word extinction.
And so with that, we'd like to take your questions. And if you could just announce where you're from, that would be great.
At this time, to ask an audio question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from Jeffrey Toobin.
Hi, everyone. I have a boring procedural question, which is, why are these suits ripe for decision now? I mean, I thought the individual mandate comes into effect in 2014. Why aren't these judges saying, just, you know, we'll deal with that when it's part of the law? And secondarily, and I think someone alluded to this, or this is, I read something about this, what about the standing argument? I mean, who has, is it clear that these various attorney generals or the other plaintiffs have standing to raise these complaints about the law?
Jeff, the California judge who has already decided this case completely agreed with you and agreed that before close to 2014, there's really no any of the claims of this kind are not ripe for a decision. So you would be on firm ground in his district. The Justice Department, needless to say, has strongly argued exactly what you are saying. The department has argued that attorneys general don't have standing to protest a federal law that is allegedly objectionable to individual residents or citizens of their states. The Virginia district judge has rejected that argument, but it certainly is a strong argument, and there's no reason to know whether other courts will agree or disagree, and particularly the Supreme Court. And they've also argued strongly that even individuals who claim they don't want to be covered by the mandate can't raise that claim until 2014. So those are very strong arguments you're making, and we'll see how the various courts respond to them.
Tim, did you?
If I could elaborate a little bit on that.
In
the Virginia case, there's a long line of cases in the Supreme Court that have held that, the courts do not hear merely hypothetical questions, and that states cannot challenge the constitutionality of a federal law simply because they disagree with, and in particular, that states can't challenge a federal law under what is called a parens patriae theory, which is that we are suing on behalf of our citizens, because the citizens of the state are, of course, citizens of the federal government as well. And in the Virginia case, what the judge held, and I think he essentially made new law on this one, is that since the state had adopted a statute nullifying the federal law, it could create standing itself by doing that. The court then had jurisdiction to hear the state defend its own statute. In the Michigan case, what the court held was that even though the law doesn't go into effect until 2014, people who realize that the law will someday affect them would begin planning now. Didn't they use the example of they wouldn't go buy a movie ticket because they had to save up money for their insurance someday? It seemed to me the judge in both cases really wanted to get to the merits. But I think you're absolutely right, and the Justice Department has argued this very strongly, that nobody knows who's going to be affected by this law in 2014. Actually, it won't even be until 2015 when they would experience any penalty when they file their taxes. And so these cases aren't ripe, and nobody has standing right now to challenge them.
Yeah, well, I actually saw, I guess, only one brief from the Virginia case, and I didn't see the standing argument, but I guess there's probably been a lot filed. I mean, all of this assumes, and I don't want to go off on a tangent, but I mean, all of this assumes that judges actually take seriously these procedural arguments when they want to reach the merits or don't want to reach the merits, and they're just convenient vehicles either way. But it is interesting to note that they, I mean, it certainly makes sense that they have argued this, since it's a pretty obvious argument.
I think it's a strong argument.
Yeah, and particularly relatively conservative judges and justices take this seriously.
Can we go to the next question?
Your next question comes from Julian Puckett.
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a couple of questions. Number one, you've mentioned multiple times now that the importance of the Michigan case was that the judge recognized the theory underlining the whole bill and how it stands all together. If you don't mandate the people buy coverage, then they'll wait to get sick. I don't understand how that's a legal argument on the merits of whether or not the individual mandate is constitutional.
Well, I'll just give you a brief recitation of the Tim and Nira may want to add something to it. Basically, the common sense and policy argument for why we need an individual mandate here is really the same as the constitutional argument. Constitutional law is very clear that Congress not only has the power to regulate commerce, which it's certainly doing when it enacted this law that regulates an industry that occupies 17% of the American economy, but it also has the power to use any means that is necessary and proper. And there is a clause in the Constitution called the Necessary and Proper Clause that is necessary and proper to make the regulatory scheme that it has enacted effective and workable. And in this case, in order to assure that people can get access to insurance without regard to whether they have pre-existing conditions and so forth, it's necessary, Congress has determined it with a very strong basis, it's necessary to have an individual mandate provision. And that completely tracks the doctrine of, that Congress can do things that are necessary and proper to make a regulatory scheme effective.
Also, and just to add to that, in the most recent extensive consideration of the Commerce Clause, Gonzalez versus Raich, medical marijuana case in which the court gave a very expansive definition of the Commerce Clause, Justice Scalia especially wrote a concurring opinion emphasizing this necessary and proper argument. This isn't just the left wing of the court. Across the Supreme Court, there's a recognition, or has been a recognition, of very broad power in Congress to regulate commerce. And if the government is going to regulate the insurance industry to make it available to people regardless of health status and pre-existing conditions, this is an essential element of this. It's absolutely necessary.
Okay, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's proper. They still have to.
Well, necessary and proper has been interpreted to mean that basically that this is something that has to be done to regulate commerce, that it doesn't give the Supreme Court an independent authority to decide whether it's a political matter it agrees with the legislation or not, or a philosophical matter. In fact, what the previous cases have said is that it's not really even for the Supreme Court to decide whether Congress is doing the right thing. The only question is, could Congress have rationally concluded that this was a proper approach? Did it make the right decision? And that's the question that the courts have to decide.
Right, and I would just add to that by saying that expert after expert, experience after experience, shows that this isn't just rational, but it's necessary. Let's move on to the next question. And can I just remind folks to push one? Oh, I'm sorry. Push number one to ask our star one. My apologies to ask questions.
Your next question comes from Megan McCarthy.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I am curious how much impact you think these decisions have at the district court level if the case does reach the Supreme Court.
Tim, do you want to take that?
I mean, I think it will depend on how persuasive their reasoning is, because the Supreme Court is going to be primarily concerned with its own precedents, with the law as it has been decided by the Supreme Court, and if the question hasn't been addressed by the Supreme Court, by the persuasiveness of the opinions of the various lower courts. But ultimately, if the case gets to the Supreme Court will have to decide, and it's not going to, I mean, it will depend on how persuasive the reasoning is of the courts below.
Okay. Should we go to the next question?
Our next question comes from Paul Heldman.
Hi. Thanks for holding the call. For the sake of this question, let's say the courts strike down the requirement that people buy coverage. Would the other parts of the Affordable Care Act stand?
Well, that's a very important. That would become a very important question. One hopes that it doesn't have to be faced, but it could become an important part of the question. It could become an important question. There is no so-called severability clause in this statute. That is to say, there's no clause that says if one part is unconstitutional, the rest of the law stands, or these parts of the law stands. So the court would have to decide what of the rest of the law might be affected, and it would do so on the basis of a doctrine of trying to determine would Congress what provisions of the law would Congress have enacted even without the provision that was struck down. So in order to try at this point to speculate on what parts of the law would stand and what would not stand is fairly difficult to do. There are some provisions that are really quite indispensably linked to the individual mandate, and there are others which have some relation to it, and then there are others which don't seem to have very much relationship to it.
I would only say that, really the core of the legislation is a series of interlocking parts. I mean, there are obviously aspects of it like long-term care and payment reform, but the real core of the legislation is three pieces that work together: insurance reforms, the minimum coverage provision, and then the subsidies for health insurance, all working through the state exchanges that are created. When we were drafting the legislation, working with the Congress, you know, that was the core of the core of the framework that everyone adopted. All the bills and every committee had this core characteristic, and they worked together because to the extent that you don't have a minimum coverage requirement and you're trying to insure people, your costs will go up. The federal government costs will go up because there will be experiences of death spirals, et cetera, and people somewhat gaming the system to get health insurance. So it's a little hard. I agree with Sy. It's a little hard to foresee how these elements would really sufficiently work if we lose a central aspect of this. But obviously, there are creative policymakers who will hopefully never have to take that question.
If I could respond very quickly to that, two things. One is, earlier this year, the Supreme Court struck down a provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley law that also does not contain a severability clause, but did not then strike down the rest of the statute, upheld the rest of the statute. So that's certainly a possibility here. But the other point is, this is a statute that was adopted to make our private insurance system work. It's clearly constitutional. It would clearly be constitutional for the government to create a national public insurance system. We have that in Medicare and Medicaid. But this statute was adopted to make the private insurance system work. And the individual mandate, in fact, has been proposed from time to time by politicians across a wide spectrum of the political and ideological spectrum, because it is a way to make a private insurance system work. So if the entire Title I was thrown out, I think where we would be with more people uninsured than we've had in the past, fewer people insured. For this year, the number of people insured dropped for the first time since the census has been keeping records. We have over 50 million people uninsured, and the courts can't make that problem go away. Something needs to be done about it. And this is a solution that was adopted to make our private insurance system work.
And let me just add briefly, from the policy perspective, You know, the irony of these challenges is that the actual idea of an individual mandate, a minimum coverage provision that affected individuals, is actually its origins are not bipartisan. Its origins are conservative. It came from, Stuart Butler from the Heritage Foundation is one of its leading advocates. John Chafee, Senator Chafee, proposed it in 1994. He wanted one large individual mandate with subsidies, which is very close to this legislation. And obviously, Governor Romney, there were lots of Democrats in Massachusetts who advocated for an employer mandate. Governor Romney insisted on a minimum coverage provision, an individual requirement. And so the irony of these challenges is that that the argument about this has actually come from has come from conservatives who recognize the importance of keeping a private health insurance system.
Your next question comes from Ari Dev of
ACB. Sorry, I missed the top of the call. I guess there was a problem with the conference call, and I just want to make sure I'm clear on exactly what we'll hear from Vincent today. Is there anyone who could just reiterate that real quick?
Tim, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, very quickly. He will be deciding on the government's motion to dismiss, which will address really two questions. One is whether the court has jurisdiction to hear the case at all, which will involve the kinds of standing and ripeness questions that we discussed a little earlier on the call. Mm-hmm. And then the second question will be, is there any plausible, arguable case on the part of the state here on any of the claims? And in fact, that's the question he'll have to decide. There's not going to be any final decision on the merits today because there has been no motion for a decision on the merits.
So we're not going to get to the constitutional question in Florida today like we already got in Michigan.
No.
Is that correct?
No.
Well, we won't get a final resolution of those questions, but the judge will have to address whether the constitutional claims that have been made by the attorneys general are so unfounded that they should just be dismissed at the outset, or whether there might possibly be an arguable basis for them such that the case should go forward and the attorneys general should be allowed to put on evidence to support those claims. There won't be a final ruling, but there will be that much.
Sorry about that. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Jane Norman of the Congressional Quarterly.
Yeah, hi. This question was for Tim Jost. I think you said earlier when discussing this that if the federal government wins any part of this, that would be a huge win for the Department of Justice. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more, why this would be so huge for them?
Yeah, because this is a motion to dismiss. And so if, the Medicaid claim or the commandeering claim or the required health insurance purchase claim, minimum coverage claim, are dismissed, that's the end of the case with respect to those claims. If the judge rules against the government, that merely means that we now go to summary judgment. But if the court rules on any of the claims on the motion to dismiss, it means that's the end of the claim.
I think we have time for one more question.
Your next question comes from Alan Cooper of VA Lawyers Weekly.
Judge Hudson's opinion, denying the motion to dismiss and setting up for the summary judgment argument on Monday, has this sentence in it: no reported case from any federal appellate court has extended the Commerce Clause or Tax Clause to include the regulation of a person's decision not to purchase a product, notwithstanding its effect on interstate commerce. And that position is very much the thrust of the state's brief. Would you comment on the legitimacy of that argument?
Tim, do you want to start since you were talking about it from the perspective of Virginia?
Sure. The argument here is that the larger argument is that the government cannot regulate inactivity; it can only regulate activity. And the way in which Judge Stee in Michigan rephrased that question, which I think is the right question, is the government can Congress can regulate economic decisions. And also he noted a number of precedents for that. For example, in the civil rights cases, what the defendants were saying in the public accommodations cases is I just don't want to do business with minorities. And so I'm essentially inactive. I'm not doing anything that can be regulated here. And what the court said is that, what the Supreme Court said, is that the decision not to do business is itself a decision that can be regulated by Congress. And I think here, I mean, when you make the decision not to purchase insurance, bottom line, we can't decide that we're never going to get sick or injured. You just can't decide that. If there's the possibility of getting sick or injured, as the court said in Michigan, it's a question, do I pay by check or do I pay by credit card? I can either buy my insurance now or I can wait till I get sick and injured. And if I can't afford the care, which of course happens to the tune of $43 billion a year in the United States, I pass the cost on to somebody else. So that's what the government is regulating here. It's regulating the decision not to do the responsible thing. And it's saying, do the responsible thing, get insurance, don't pass your costs on to other people.
And the only thing I would add to that is, from the perspective of policymakers, health care isn't like other markets. Like, if you choose to buy a Snickers bar, it really doesn't affect my life. But when you choose not to buy a Snickers bar, it doesn't affect my life. But when you choose not to buy health insurance and you get sick, we have laws that require hospitals and doctors to take care of you. So I do end up paying for your coverage indirectly. That's why we have rising, from part of the reasons, that's part of the cost of your premium or my premium today. And so that's what distinguishes the health insurance market from other markets, which is that consumers who purchase, who do the right thing and have health insurance, are paying for all those people who don't have health insurance and get sick. And that was exactly the reason why the Congress enacted a minimum coverage provision, because to do otherwise was to shift cost burdens onto people who have health insurance, and in some sense, intolerably high cost burdens onto people who have health insurance. And that's why this is a market decision that affects everyone. Your decision not to purchase health insurance will ultimately affect me and everyone else.
And that's exactly what the Michigan district judge said was the basis for his decision to uphold the law. The health insurance market is a market that you cannot choose not to enter. You're already in it. That is to say, the health care market is a market no one can choose not to enter. You're already in it. The law is regulating the timing and nature of the way in which you pay for those services.
And with that, I'd like to thank everybody. Thank you all for your questions. And I'd like to thank Tim and Cy for joining the call. And again, thank everyone on behalf of the Center for American Progress. And we were honored to do this in conjunction with the American Constitution Society.